listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the fall of 1976, John Moore's doctor informed him that he had a rare and lethal form of leukemia and that his spleen, which had become seriously enlarged, had to be removed. The surgery was a success and Mr. Moore recovered, but what he didn't know was that his doctor had benefited from the surgery as well. Years later, he learned that the doctor had kept the spleen and was using it in his medical research along with other cells that he had harvested from Mr. Moore in follow-up appointments. The doctor, it turned out, had developed a valuable cell line that was estimated to be worth $3 million. After a series of legal battles, it was determined that John Moore was not entitled to any of those profits. In fact, he couldn't claim any ownership of the cells that had been made from his own body. And how that happened is the subject of medical ethicist Harriet Washington's latest book called Deadly Monopolies, The Shocking Corporate Takeover of Life Itself and the Consequences for Your Health and a Medical Future. It's published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased to welcome Harriet Washington back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you so much, Leonard, for having me here.
Your first book, Medical Apartheid, which won a National Book Critics Circle Award, was about the medical ethics violations against African-American patients, like the Tuskegee experiment in the 1930s. Did your thinking on this grow out of that?
No, I actually had been long concerned both about the treatment of African-Americans, a disparate treatment of African-Americans in medical research, and the increasing commercialization of medical research, which is serving to not only skew the values of medical researchers, but also to separate us from the type of health care that we needed rather than to bring us closer as we had been promised.
Well, you came to the conclusion in the first book that because of Tuskegee and other incidents, the African-American community had become skeptical of the medical community. Are we seeing a growing feeling among Americans as a result of these new issues, or are most people largely unaware of the loopholes in medical patent law that allow for cases like John Moore's?
Interestingly, both things are happening. The American public is increasingly becoming disenchanted with the high prices and the inability to actually procure the sorts of medications for the most important diseases. But I'm not sure they realize the extent to which the profit motive is motoring these changes.
Well, the book about Henrietta Lacks' cell line has been a bestseller, and she's been made into a hero. Are the issues there similar to the ones in the Moore case?
There are many, many issues here. One set of them is very similar to the Moore case. In fact, it's exacerbated today because Henrietta Lacks' tissues were not patented. And that removed a large part of the monetary, the profit motive. But today, tissues are valuable because they're patented. And actually, whereas John Moore and Henrietta Lacks' tissues were valuable because they were unusual, today it is normal tissues in large quantities that provide a lot of wealth for people who hold patents. And so you and I are now vulnerable to the same kind of appropriation that Henrietta Lacks and John Moore suffered.
And you're right that there's a lack of transparency in the way that human cells may be collected by medical researchers and used for non-consensual studies. When did this begin? Has it always been the case?
It had always been the case, but on a much lower level. The patent didn't actually enter the stage as a primary motivation until the year 1980, a watershed year for the transformation of medical research. In 1980, a court ruling, actually a law, the Bayh-Dole Act, was passed, very narrowly passed.
And that's Bob Dole and Birch Bayh?
That's right. Birch Bayh and Bob Dole co-sponsored a law that for the first time enabled universities to legally sell or license their patents to industry.
And was this an attempt to help the universities with their funding?
Well, it was sold to the American public as a route to more and better medicines. The idea being that Birch Bayh lamented that we've got all these patents generated by universities that are just lying around, lying fallow. No one's developing, no one's making medicines out of them. If we have universities and corporations partnering, we'll have a bevy of medications for the things that affect us. Unfortunately, his prediction was wrong.
Well, mice have been patented for a while, mice cells. In theory, couldn't a whole human be patented?
In theory, yes. The patent office reassures us that it will never patent an entire human being. But I searched in vain and spoke to experts in vain looking for a statute that would prohibit it. Typically, people point to anti-slavery statutes as prohibiting the patenting of an entire human being. So we'll have to be reassured by that.
Then there was this court case, Chakrabarty versus Diamond. And mm-hmm. that is the key decision in all of this?
Again, another law in 1980, that watershed year, this law for the first time legally validated the patenting of living things. Now, living things had been patented sporadically before then, but it was very sporadic and they often gave rise to court challenges. For example, when Takamine first isolated adrenaline, there was an immediate challenge saying that's a product of a living thing. You can't do that. And even people questioned Louis Pasteur when he first isolated a yeast and got a patent on it. So it was
happening. But a yeast can't sue him in court.
Well, no, but people who have an interest, who say they have an interest, can sue him. Hmm. People who, for example, might want to sell the yeast themselves and don't want to be impeded by a patent, don't want to pay Pasteur a license, might sue him. But so in 1980, it established for once and for all the right of universities and researchers to do this.
And then there was this court case, Chakrabarty versus Diamond. The ruling there specifically that anything made by man under the sun could be patented. That pretty much broadened the whole concept of what was patentable. Yeah.
Yes. It expanded it to living things. Now, of course, there are criteria for a patent. You know, it has to be something that's quote-unquote invented. It's got to be novel. It's got to be useful. But if it meets those criteria, the fact that it's alive is not going to any longer be a bar to a patent.
But why have the courts been so unsympathetic toward people like John Moore?
I think the courts have been very unsympathetic because of something that happens whenever there's a challenge. When an individual challenges the patenting of genes from his body or tissues from his body, very quickly, friend of the court briefs are filed by heavy hitters. Large universities, Harvard, Yale, Wisconsin, Stanford, and large groups of medical researchers. And their overarching argument is always that if we permit this person's challenge to go forth and invalidate this patent, you're going to impede medical research. The courts are swayed by this argument.
But couldn't they say, okay, we'll work out some kind of arrangement. John Moore gets 10% of the profits because he supplied us with the cells. I'm sure he would have been very happy.
They certainly could say that, but we're no longer dealing with researchers. We're dealing with corporations who have stockholders, and the corporations are not interested in sharing their profits.
Well, isn't the mention of anything made by man under the sun kind of ironic? Because 25 years before that court decision, when Edward R. Murrow asked Jonas Salk about patenting the polio vaccine, Salk mentioned the sun.
Exactly. And in fact, I always wondered, was there some kind of sly echo there of someone who had Salk in mind? But yes, and actually Salk's behavior was the norm for the country until 1980. Medical researchers didn't seek money. And when he was able to perfect the polio vaccine, which was certain to be extremely lucrative, Edward R. Murrow asked him, well, who's going to hold the patent to this, you know? He said, the American people, I guess. Could you patent the sun?
Well, I guess somebody's going to try to do that soon. Harriet A. Washington's latest book is Deadly Monopolies, The Shocking Corporate Takeover of Life Itself and the Consequences for Your Health and Our Medical Future. It is published by Doubleday. You write that there are 40,000 genes or DNA sequences that are currently protected by U.S. patents. 40,000. Don't many of us already carry those genes
exactly.
As a normal consequence of having been born into the human race?
These genes reside in our body, and yet corporations hold the patent on them. That makes a company like Chiron or Myriad, in essence, our biological landlords.
So am I in violation of patent law?
You have to be careful. You could become in violation. The women who seek a BRCA test to determine their risk for breast cancer, they actually are behind a successful challenge to the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene patents. They said Myriad shouldn't hold a patent on these genes because it's affecting our ability to get good diagnosis and good care. And they actually won last year. Unfortunately, the federal appeals court overturned it, reversed that. And the next stop seems to be the Supreme Court. We'll have a definitive decision.
What would a scientist need my cells for?
Oh, your cells are useful for many, many things. If you're if you undergo surgery at certain universities here, including the ones affiliated with Harvard, you're presented with a new consent form to sign. Not one dictating your care, but one signing over to a private corporation your tissues, which are described often as your discarded worthless tissues. Of course they're not worthless. If they were worthless, the company wouldn't want them. And so you assign them. When they obtain these tissues, they're useful for many things. They're useful for testing medications. They're useful for testing procedures. They're also useful for generating, for pharmacogenomics, for looking at genetic clues and directions for new drug research. And drug research, as we know, the third most profitable industry on the globe, is very profitable.
So I'm given this form and I'm asked to sign it and I don't understand what it is and I want the medical work done. And so I sign it, totally unaware of what I'm doing. What happens if I don't sign it?
Well, by law, you cannot be refused your procedure for not signing it. But how many patients know that? As someone who worked in a hospital for many years, I recognize a scenario. 6 o'clock in the morning, you're groggy, you've been awoken, you've been handed a sheaf of papers to sign, your nurse or the surgeon is standing over you, and many patients, even if they know enough to wonder whether this is something they should do, are going to be reluctant to anger the medical team. They feel they need the medical team as their allies. And then, of course, there's a case in North Carolina where someone I know who oversees these things tells me that when she has confronted surgeons telling them, you haven't given me an informed consent form for these tissues you take, they'll say things like, they'll sign. This is after the fact. So, you know, there's this sense of entitlement.
You also suggest that an increasing number of medical patents has been fueled by the loss of federal funding for the U.S. Patent Office. How did that work out?
Well, actually what happened was that the Patent Office now, it's not so much a loss of funding. It's more a much closer relationship with industry than it once had. You know, I use the iconic case of the thalidomide. How the United States only had about 16 children born with birth defects from thalidomide because Dr. Francis Kelsey refused to approve it. But what would happen today? Today it would be very difficult. In fact, it is very difficult for the medical examiners of the patent office to, according to their blogs, they say it's very difficult to turn things down and that many things are being patented that they don't think, you know, that they have questions about.
But they're also relying on the fees to pay their way.
Exactly. And, of course, the fees, I think, create a conflict of interest. You know, the fact that you're receiving monies from the corporations who are seeking approval from you. That's also true of the FDA, by the way.
Now, the Bayh-Dole Act is just one of the pieces of legislation that plays a part here. There's also the Stevenson-Wydler Act.
Right.
What happened there?
It's sort of support of Bayh-Dole. It provides tax incentives for universities to partner with corporations. And that was initially important, although today universities, research centers, and corporations work so closely together with them receiving so much money from corporations that for me, it's sometimes hard to tell where the corporation ends and the university begins.
So is this what is this why you've put the word monopoly in your title, this partnership between universities, the drug companies, and the U.S. government?
Yes. Well, a patent is a monopoly. It's for 20 years, you were given sole exclusive right to not only sell, if it's legal to sell it, your the thing that you have a patent on, but also you can prevent anybody else from doing research on that gene, prevent anybody else from you know, actually exploring that gene, using that gene, devising a test for that. So you have a monopoly on the use of it. Chiron, for example, holds 100 patents on the hepatitis C virus. And no other researchers in the world are able to devise a test or devise a treatment without a license from Chiron.
Harriet A. Washington, her previous book was Medical Apartheid, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award and the 2007 Penn Oakland Award. She's been a fellow in medical ethics at the Harvard Medical School, a senior research scholar at the National Center for Bioethics at Tuskegee University, a fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health, and the recipient of the John S. Knight Fellowship at Stanford University. Her latest book, Deadly Monopolies, is published by Doubleday. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Harriet A. Washington, her latest book, Deadly Monopolies, the shocking corporate takeover of life itself and the consequences for your health and our medical future. It's published by Doubleday. You say shocking. Some people might not be shocked, right? The courts don't seem to be shocked.
No. Well, the courts don't seem to be shocked. Of course, the courts are dictating a lot of the legislation we're talking about, so there's no... But I think the American people might be shocked if they knew some of these details.
But you're also arguing that these laws have been harmful to innovation. In what way?
Exactly. That's the irony. In many ways. If we look at the sort of drugs that have been developed, the interesting thing is that defenders of the system will point to the number of new drugs on the market. And that's actually problematic because there were a lot of new drugs coming to the market, but the pace has slowed appreciably.
And aren't many of them copycat drugs?
Exactly. And of those that are being developed, I think something like 42%, only 42% are new drugs now. Most are copycats. And they're also drugs for trivial but prevalent illnesses. We have many, many drugs for digestive disorders, but we don't have new drugs for malaria. We have many, many drugs for erectile dysfunction, but we don't. But our only new drug for sleeping sickness, African sleeping sickness, we pulled from the market and began using for facial hair instead.
Is that because those drugs, which would be sent to developing countries, can't bring in the kinds of profits that the drug companies would like? Malaria is a major problem all around the world. Even if you made a penny on every dose, you'd still make a lot of money, wouldn't you?
Well, that's my stance. And actually, very recently, people like Bill Gates have been appealing to the pharmaceutical companies with exactly that argument. And the companies are realizing now, because they are generating fewer and fewer new drugs, and because a lot of their blockbuster drugs are going off patent, they know that they need new markets. So there are these advanced market commitments designed to develop drugs for the developing world.
Going off patent means after, what, 20 years, you can create a generic version? But don't they have all sorts of tactics to keep themselves
exactly
on patent even longer?
The law indicates 20 years. However, they have what they call lifestyle management, ways to extend the patent for months and months and years beyond that 20 years. So the 20-year figure is really chimerical. It's not really accurate.
What role does the FDA play in the system?
Well, as I mentioned before, the FDA is a watchdog. We think of it as our watchdog to protect us from bad medicines and promulgate good ones. However, that role has been stymied by the fact that it now receives a good proportion of the funds. I can't recall the exact amount. I think 40% of the funds that it needs to evaluate new drugs from the makers of those drugs themselves. Another, you know, very blatant conflict of interest. So now we find the FDA, according to its own internal medication evaluators, the FDA is approving more and more drugs that have to be withdrawn from the market a few years later because they turn out to be so dangerous.
What are your thoughts about the calls by most of the Republican candidates to get rid of the FDA? Are they doing it to protect the American public?
I can't tell you what their mindset is, but I can tell you that we desperately need an FDA that resembles the FDA of the 1950s when we had a physician who was able to protect us from a drug like thalidomide, an FDA that listens to its evaluators rather than putting their their reports aside and takes to heart their responsibility to American public and not to the corporation. So we need a stronger FDA, according to an Institute of Medicine report.
You say in the book that you became more aware of how all of this thing works when you returned to school as a journalism fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health. What happened?
That was actually quite funny. I had worked in medical research labs at a very low level, I hasten to add, just a lowly technician. But I had done that for a long time. Then I had become a... among other things, a journalist. So I was, I left journalism to go back to the Harvard School of Public Health. And when everyone was on the first day of class exercise, they were all saying, oh, I worked in tropical medicine. Oh, I've worked in this laboratory. I've worked in the developing world. And it was my turn. And I was like, I'm a journalist. You know, I was very embarrassed. And all my professors were galvanized and were very interested in me and came basically courting me. They besieged me, asked me to lunch, have me tour their labs. And I was completely flummoxed, you know, like they're ignoring the medical geniuses and lavishing attention on me. And I realized that all these professors had fledgling biotech companies. And they were looking for publicity. They were looking for someone to bring that they hoped would bring their company to the attention of a big corporation.
Returning to an earlier theme, one of my listeners, Brian, asks, can we patent ourselves?
Patent ourselves?
Yeah, why don't, instead of letting a drug company patent my genes, I just simply patent myself? Or would I be patenting genes that have already been patented?
Practical answer is no, because few of us can afford the fees. And it would take a long time. An English poet actually tried to patent herself, you know, as a symbolic protest against this. Mm. I don't think it's going to be a practical field. I think the answer lies in preventing corporations from receiving patents from universities.
Going back to something we were discussing, you're right that although pharmaceutical companies have made incredible strides in curing diseases, they also remind us that these cures are luxury goods because the drugs are often very expensive.
Hmm. Well, the drugs have very high prices. Now, whether they're expensive is a different question. They claim that their R&D costs a minimum of $800 million for every new pill. And that estimate has actually gone up to $2 billion recently. But I dissect that claim in my book, showing that it is essentially a tissue of lies, specious charges. They base their charge on very unusual drugs that tend to be rare and expensive. They don't base it on the everyday drugs. They also ignore their substantial tax benefits, and they add the spurious opportunity charge that doubled the price. You can't apply an opportunity charge to this kind of calculation. So basically, the drugs are not inherently expensive, but in this country, in the U.S., nothing prevents companies from charging whatever they like for a drug.
And that's why they're a lot less expensive in many other places outside of the United States, the
exactly.
same drugs. Are they taking a loss when they sell those drugs in France or in Great Britain or Germany?
No. The pharmaceutical companies there are doing very well, but their governments do not permit them to charge anything. In Canada, for example, Canadian government has a board that looks at potential prices for medications, new medications, and they apply a formula to ensure that Canadians pay somewhere near the median price paid by people in every country. But in this country, companies are allowed to set their own price.
But we also don't see drug ads on television in other countries.
Nobody else permits that. Nothing like
what we see on 60 Minutes every where those drug ads come on, and then they tell us that if we take them, we're likely to go blind and have a heart attack.
Yeah.
But it's good for us anyway.
Exactly. That's true. Direct-to-consumer advertisements are not permitted in most countries. Other countries do not allow this end run around physicians.
Well, do those marketing costs get included in what the drug companies say it takes to bring a drug to market?
Sometimes, but usually the costs that are included are things like phony clinical trials. These are real clinical trials, but they are not. Their purpose is not to get FDA approval. In fact, the industry spends a lot of money on clinical trials of drugs that are already FDA approved, because these clinical trials' only purpose is to generate positive data, which is selectively taken to sell this drug to doctors.
My guest is Harriet A. Washington. Her latest book is called Deadly Monopolies. It's published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. We talked earlier about pharmaceutical companies being reluctant to sell some drugs to people in developing countries because they just can't make as much of a profit. But haven't they sometimes used impoverished people as test subjects?
They habitually use people in developing countries as test subjects. A New England Journal of Medicine article, a recent one, found that one-third of clinical trials conducted by U.S. researchers are conducted abroad. And we're talking poor developing countries where people do not have access to health care as we do. Nigeria, Brazil, Indian villages, and even parts of Eastern Europe.
And you write about something that took place in Kano, Nigeria in the late 90s. What happened?
Oh, Pfizer conducted research there with an experimental antibiotic. And this antibiotic caused the deaths and deafness and disfigurement in many children in Nigeria. Kano conducted their trial in a duplicitous manner. They conducted it. There was a question about whether the people had, there was any consent at all, never mind informed consent. People did not understand that they were in an experimental trial. And Pfizer took care to set its tents up right next to a Doctors Without Borders clinic. And the people there did not have a good appreciation of which, you know, who was treating them. They thought it was treatment. It was research. So after they collected their data, the Pfizer doctors had flown out. And when the parents of these injured and killed children sued them both in Nigeria and in Manhattan, where they were found not to have standing, and eventually received a settlement from Pfizer. But, you know, even then there were problems with collecting the settlement. So it was a very ugly situation, and it really does epitomize what's happening in the third world with clinical trials by these research, by these corporations.
On the other hand, is it possible to do studies on diseases like malaria, meningitis, or dengue fever in any places other than in the areas where they are prevalent?
That's a fair question, and that's often a rationale for the research. However, you have to keep in mind that the research is not done to benefit people in those countries. We know that for many reasons. For a long time, a lot of these companies have had a policy against testing their drugs for disease of the tropical world, so that they tend not to do that kind of research because they know those people can't afford it. Also, between 1975 and 1997, of all the medications devised by researchers in this country, only 4 medications were devised that would treat people in the developing world. So that's not the purpose. The purpose is to test medications that will ultimately be used in the industrialized nations, but which the people who provide the test subjects will never have access to.
Let me read some of the questions that have been coming in from listeners. Alan in Elmont wants to know, if patents are held on cells, genes, or DNA structures in your body, can you sue that patent holder if you develop a disease related to that cell or gene?
No.
Amy wants to know, Amy from Manhattan, could a patient make a case that he or she signed away the right only to worthless tissues and the ones that were patented aren't covered by that because they're not worthless?
Clever argument, but who decides what the worth of the tissue is? I think that's where your problem comes in.
And a third listener wants to know whether or not a new patent law update sponsored by Senator Patrick Leahy will change anything. I know you've called for the repeal of Bayh-Dole, but that seems unlikely, doesn't it?
As I admit in my book, I'm not optimistic this will happen soon, but I'm not sure it's unlikely. You know, people said that it was very unlikely that any of the gene patents would ever be overturned. In fact, when the BRCA 1 and BRCA 2 patents were overturned last year, the headline of the genomics report read, "Pigs fly." You know, but it happened, taking the experts by surprise.
So, but as you point out, in the end, it may just be back to normal when the Supreme Court makes a decision. The Supreme Court has to make the final decision, and they'll probably, in this case, follow precedent.
We don't know. We don't know. See, there's something exciting, something very different about this case, and that is, while in the past, as I mentioned, researchers had all fought tooth and nail against for the patents, now we have researchers on the side of the plaintiffs. They're siding with everyday people.
Why is that?
Well, it's really interesting. I think some researchers are beginning to understand what they have lost in partnering with corporations. Researchers have lost their autonomy. They've lost, too. I mean, I've spoken
to... Because they're being pressured to do the research in certain areas and not others?
Exactly. I've spoken to researchers who've had very... One researcher had a very successful liver cancer medication. He was in the last phase of clinical trials, and the corporation pulled the plug. Not because the drug didn't show great promise, which it did. They pulled the plug on his life's work because they said, there's too much competition in this field, and this drug will probably not be a blockbuster. We no longer want to invest in it. They hold the patent. He can't go elsewhere to develop his drug. So 20 years of his life's work is now down the tubes, and we're left without a liver cancer medication.
Can he wait for 20 years and then develop his own generic version?
He's no spring chicken now, but he's pretty energetic. He might be able to wait for 20 years, but will he be able to? I mean, is that a reasonable request, you know?
Mm-hmm. Especially if that drug might do some good.
Right. So researchers are beginning to understand that they're being thwarted, too, in their desire to ameliorate human health.
So what about the Leahy legislation?
Well, it's very difficult to talk about its chances at this stage. I'll say it's not the first legislation like this. Becerra and Weldon in California proposed similar legislation a few years ago. It didn't really go anywhere. I think that if it's passed, it will definitely be a step in the right direction. But the devil is always in the details with these rules, so we'd have to see what it looks like by the time it's actually brought to a vote. But it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Harriet A. Washington's book, Deadly Monopolies, The Shocking Corporate Takeover of Life Itself and the Consequences for Your Health and Our Medical Future, is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Leonard.